Welcome to the next edition of the Resources Podcast Series. In this episode, we had the opportunity to speak with Alan Laser, attorney at law, and former county court at law judge in Victoria County, Texas. Listen as Mr. Laser shares with us the importance of proper estate planning, including medical wishes and directives, and the frequency with which one should review and update their wills. We're going to talk today about issues no one really wants to discuss. That's really talking about their own mortality and planning for it or failing to plan for it. We know that they're really tough subjects, but we've got to talk about them and discuss what happens when you do and when you don't plan accordingly. Everyone has a will, either written by the state where you live or one that you've written or executed yourself. If you fail to plan, what are some of those issues with a will actually being drafted by the state?
Well, the biggest problem is that some of your property may end up with somebody you don't want it to end up with. The other real problems with not planning well is that your assets that you've taken usually a lifetime to accumulate are pretty much at the whim and will of people that you don't know and often who don't have your interest at heart. The court, in some instances, will have to appoint what's called an administrator. And an administration is a very expensive, time-consuming, and very tedious way to administer assets. It's what happens when you don't plan. Normally in Texas, when someone writes a will, we have a streamlined process where both the will is admitted to probate very quickly and very simply without the necessity of witnesses. And then the court's jurisdiction comes to an end. The person who you've designated to be the executor of the will, the person who's to carry out its terms, is able to function without court supervision, usually without a bond, and be able to pay off all the debts, gather up all the property, and distribute it to those people who are entitled to receive it under the terms of the will in a very streamlined and simple process that's, for the most part, pretty inexpensive. And it's been the way we've done things for over 100 years. So the courts are very familiar with how to do it, and it works very well.
Okay. But the opposite is true. If you don't plan, then it just becomes a legal mess, I would assume.
It's a mess. Every single aspect of an administration is court supervised. And that requires, like everything in court, you have to file a motion. Motion set for a hearing, a lawyer has to go to court, there has to be a decision made by a judge, an order has to be entered, and then whatever it was that was anticipated by the motion, that action takes place. Car gets sold, house gets sold, debts get paid, whatever the case may be. And then you have to go back to court and tell the judge, hey, we've done it, here's what happened, and we want you to approve it. And so that process, as you can imagine, at least two court appearances, at least two orders, which the lawyers prepare, a motion, lawyer time's expensive. And so at the end of the day, most of the costs are borne by the very people who were the intended beneficiaries of someone's life's work.
Right. Ugh. What happens if you do execute a will, but it's just a holographic one, one that's handwritten? Are there problems there?
Sometimes, not usually, though I've seen a few. Texas permits holographic wills. We even permit what's called non-cupative wills, but those are very rare. But a holographic will is fine. The problem is you have to prove the handwriting of the testator, and that's usually pretty easy, but sometimes people are up in years. They may have lack of testamentary capacity intermittently. Somebody may have Alzheimer's disease and be in perfectly good shape today and know exactly what they're trying to do. And tomorrow, they don't. And so you just don't know. With a holographic will, it has to be entirely in the handwriting of the testator. Can't be any extraneous marks on it because you don't know what the testator intended by that. So long as it's a blank piece of paper that somebody writes down, I give everything to Joe, that'll get through probate. But it's very difficult, requires three witnesses who have to come down and say, I knew this person and I've seen them, seen their signature, seen their handwriting many times, and that's their handwriting. And sometimes people who might have an interest in the estate and might be disinherited might contest that. So it's better to have a written will. It's possible to do a holograph. They are not really favored in the law, and I can't think of a real good reason to do it. You know, occasionally we'll see somebody who's in the hospital, they're at the end of their life, they know they're dying, and they have one or two more things they want to add to a will or take out of a will, and so it becomes what's called a holographic codicil. And so they'll just write something out. And even then, they're kind of difficult. Nobody really much likes them. And judges, of course, look at those with a good deal of skepticism, as you should. Is this really, were they in the hospital? You know, were they drugged up? Were they sick? What were they thinking? If this counteracts the natural course of things, people typically leave their assets to their families. And this, they decide to leave some property to a stranger or somebody who visited them in the hospital. And then it gets questioned.
Okay. So the best bet is to actually execute one through an attorney or some other service.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
When someone is looking at to create a will with an attorney, what are some of the major issues that should be addressed?
Well, a will itself really just disposes of someone's property when they die. And that's only part of it. And so in Texas, we have the ability to do very broad planning. End-of-life issues are really often more important than some of the property dispositions. Property dispositions, for most people, their biggest asset is their home. And in Texas, again, because we have what's called a widow's homestead, that's kind of an interesting concept I'll tell you a bit about in a second. The home becomes a big deal because home prices are high, and some of these older homes particularly are in neighborhoods now in metropolitan areas like Houston, where an average home can be in an area that's being redeveloped. It can be worth a great deal of money. But people disposing of what their property consists of really involves making a very good inventory of what they own and who their beneficiaries might be. It's kind of funny, when people are planning this, they often put a greater value on things that are personal value, on things that are not really worth a great deal of money. People will sit down and talk to you as a lawyer. They'll say to me, you know, and I've got this old charm bracelet that I got from my grandmother, and you know, and they'll go on and talk endlessly about the whole history of their lives, about how this thing came to be theirs. But what's really important is they get down on paper what it is exactly they've got and that it's all disposed of in the will, so that there's, to the greatest degree possible, that the will reflects what their real intent is for what happens with their property. And that requires some clear thinking about what you've got, where it is, and so on. One of the big misconceptions is about wills is that they really can dispose of things that sometimes are not really what are called probate assets. They're assets which can pass under a will and many which don't. And some of them are very valuable, like 401k plans or IRA plans or life insurance. Things of that nature are contractual. So whatever your contract is with the brokerage house, the bank, the insurance company, as to how that property is going to go at your death, usually a beneficiary designation, that governs over a will. And people sometimes just ignore that altogether. So it's an important aspect of estate planning.
Okay. Should we also be concerned if you have children, about minor children, when you're looking at executing a will?
Yeah, that's an important thing. You know, Texas law, particularly, I'll tell you these days, it used to be that families stayed together a lot better than they do today. It's not uncommon to see people married two or three times, and sometimes you'll see families that have kids with different spouses all under the same roof. And so you have to be careful about how you want those kids to be raised, especially if you have kids. Sometimes you'll have kids in one household from a different marriage and kids from another marriage in the same household, and they become a family, an extended family. They're more like natural brothers and sisters than they are stepsisters and brothers. And so keeping that family unit together upon the death of somebody is critical. Well, it's not very easy to do because Texas law makes what's called the natural guardian the surviving parent. So if you in that situation, you have to do some planning. You can make some requests in a will, but you can't really dispossess a natural parent unless the natural parent either agrees or has some issues that would make them inappropriate to continue on as the parent of the child. And in those instances, it's really always about the best interest of the child if the court gets involved. But it's critical to get those issues vetted, talked about. If there are spouses from other marriages involved, to sit down and talk about it and discuss it. And parents very often think it's all just going to work out, or, you know, my kids will be fine. And I've seen a lot of stress generated because of that very issue, where you have multiple marriages of kids from different backgrounds living all on the same roof, and then one of the parents unfortunately dies as a result of an injury or an illness, and then you have this very issue to deal with. A natural parent who may be living in the next city or two blocks away, who normally has visitation rights, now is in a position where they have possessory rights because their former spouse died, and they may want to raise the child at home. And that's very difficult.
Okay. Could you explain the difference between a standard will and a living will?
That's a big thing. Well, the term living will really has no legal meaning at all. What a living will really is an advance directive that's designed to dispose of people's property. Not dispose of people's property. A living will really is more in the nature of a directive. There are different types. People talk about living wills, medical directives. People talk about inter vivos trusts or living trusts. There's all kinds of different ways of using that term. But ordinarily, people want to have some direction and control over their property during their lifetimes. A real will that we talk about is the last will and testament of an individual who's of suitable testamentary age, properly witnessed, and it simply disposes of their property. We can do a few other things in a will, like you can provide for your how you want your remains disposed of at your death, but not much more. You can create trust in a will. Testamentary trust can be created. If you want to not give property, say, to a minor child, then the court has to appoint a guardian of a estate to look after the property while they're not of suitable age. You can put all that into a trust, which is not something we've talked really about yet, but then you have appointed someone to handle the property in advance. But living wills usually have the connotation of either being an inter vivos trust for property or the disposition of medical issues, so that if a person becomes, in the usual situation, is mentally disabled, they want to die at home and they don't want to go through all the heroic measures you see in the hospital.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that. Yeah. So. Technology is advanced in healthcare, just as in every other aspect. Sure. So we're starting to see some of those end-of-life tools come into the estate planning and some of the planning just in general. Sure. Particularly talk about defibrillators and respirators and heroic measures. Right. How can one who is thinking about this planning address utilization or non-utilization of some of those technologies?
Well, Texas has a variety of tools. You can plan for disability and death pretty well. There are a number of ways of doing it. We have powers of attorney that you can use for appointing people to make decisions for you that will allow people to make healthcare decisions for you, where you express your own desires with respect to how you want to be handled in the event you can't make your own healthcare decisions. Doctors love them because they actually have someone to talk to, particularly in the case of elderly people. As someone who's getting there myself, I can tell you that it's a thought You reach a stage where if you're too ill to make healthcare decisions, you have the ability to have appointed a younger person, often a child, adult child, to make healthcare decisions for you. And so that kind of planning is critical if you don't want to be kept alive by artificial means. I'm not talking about nutrition, you know, but things like being on a respirator or being kept alive when really your time has come. You can provide for that. If you're in the last 6 months of your life, according to the physician's analysis, you can enter what's called a in-hospital DNR, out-of-hospital DNR, where you can say, hey, don't do CPR. I don't need cracked ribs on my way to the boneyard. I just let me go. And doctors will pretty much follow those. In my own experience, when my father was at the end of his life, he didn't have a DNR and didn't have a medical power of attorney. And so he was revived after he'd quit breathing and lived on another week. But the doctor actually apologized to me. He said, I'm sorry, we didn't know. We had to keep him going. And it was, of course, a useless and futile gesture, but nonetheless, that can happen.
With the medical directives themselves, they're actually becoming more and more popular, thankfully, so people are getting their wishes honored. Is it really more about their wishes as far as the care is concerned or the actual procedures?
You can do both. You can be very specific in those things. The general power that you get in Texas, the one the legislature has actually created, just, you can't even deviate much from the form. It pretty much gives you the ability not to specify procedures, but to say, I don't want to be kept alive by artificial means. I get nutrition, which basically means an IV, and I get morphine or other palliative type care, but I don't want you to do anything outside of that. And that's about as much planning as you can really get. Now, strangely enough, medical powers of attorney and medical directives, which are directed to a physician and a healthcare provider, as opposed to your attorney in fact, your medical attorney in fact, don't reach mental health care. And so that's a different kind of document. And the legislature allows you to decide what kind of mental health care you want with a great deal more specificity than you can your own physical health care. But it's only good for 3 years. So every 3 years you have to re-execute it. You can say, I don't want psychoactive medication, or I don't want electroconvulsive shock therapy, or I do, or I want restraint, but I don't want this, or all of those sorts of things, and what drugs I'll take and what drugs I don't want, and whether I want them administered by a female or a male, or don't care. But it's another opportunity for planning your own future.
Didn't even think about that, as I'm sure most people don't.
No, most people don't. And in my experience, whenever I'm sitting down with someone and saying, okay, but let's talk about your mental health care, they generally say, what about my mental health care? You know, it's a sensitive issue. And you say, well, look, you know, just because you're okay today doesn't mean that you're not going to get Alzheimer's disease or one of the other awful things that can happen to people. And that you may be physically okay, but you may be demented to such a degree that you can't make these decisions. And if you need care, if you need antidepressives, let's say, well, who's going to make that decision, which ones you get, and whether you're going to get them? Because the person you appointed your sister over here to be your attorney, in fact, to handle your medical care, but for your physical stuff. But that doesn't reach mental health care.
And if there's an onset of a mental illness and you've recently updated, hopefully you have, and then you have that person who is now handling that care for you, is there any time frame in which that they, or is it just until end of life that they maintain whatever you executed before the illness?
It's only good for 3 years.
Still only good for 3 years. So what happens at that 3-year mark if someone has Alzheimer's and they can't make that decision?
Well, Alzheimer's, I believe, is still considered a physical illness, but if it really came to that, I suppose we could get a guardianship, but I've never seen that occur. I think the physicians, once someone's in stabilized health care, they pretty much keep going.
As we think about what information can and cannot be given to our loved ones due to HIPAA concerns, what measures can we take to ensure that the right people are receiving the vital information about your health care or your treatment plans?
Good question. Most of the forms that are in use, and certainly the documents that I prepare for my clients, we have a HIPAA waiver in them. And generally speaking, I provide those to the physician, or ask my clients to provide those to their physicians and other healthcare providers. If for instance, you're likely to be treated at a particular hospital if you become ill, that's where your doctors are, and perhaps you've been treated there before, I always ask my clients to put one on file so that whoever has your medical power of attorney also has the HIPAA waiver and can ask for whatever they want. And the physicians are free to provide that information. It's important.
So that's another important part of this planning process. Don't forget that HIPAA form.
I put them in just about everything. I even put them in the general powers of attorney, the durable powers of attorney that we give for people to handle your business affairs, because sometimes they need medical information. And so I put them everywhere, because the doctors have gotten so touchy about that.
I've heard this term and the acronym, the POLST, the Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. Can you tell us what that term actually means?
Those things are kind of weird. They're sort of a new thing on the horizon. It's really a combination of some of the old stuff. Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. What the docs want to do is they want us to do everything, so their responsibility is for delivering health care. They don't want to make those decisions for us. And I think most people would feel more comfortable making their own health care decisions if they could. They want advice from their doctors, but they don't want the doctors to pull the trigger. They want to be in that position themselves. And these physicians' orders for life-sustaining treatment work pretty much like the medical powers of attorney do. It's essentially a pre-planning tool for providing what you want and when you want it, how you want it.
Does it get into very specific areas about the care that you do or don't want, or is it more of a broad?
Well, I think that you should use as much specificity as you can. A doctor's not going to be able to read your mind, but they are going to be able to read your chart. And most docs are going to do those things that are reasonable under the circumstances. So if there are things that, I guess that the best way to say this is that it's like the relationship you have with all the other professionals in your life, your lawyer, your accountant. You should have that same, have a close relationship with a physician, so that someone knows you and knows your wishes, and those wishes should be committed to writing in a way that's legally enforceable. Doctors aren't really gonna go against it one way or the other, but I think you should, in your planning, understand who it is that's going to be reading your plan and understand how they're going to understand it and react to it. And if they can't, you haven't really done anything. I found that I always tell my clients when they're preparing their medical powers of attorney, I say, now look, I need two or three people who have in a series who can make these decisions if you're unable to do it yourself. If you have a stroke and you can't communicate, it doesn't do any good at all if the doctor can't find somebody who's going to be able to make the decisions about what treatment you need. If you need a clot-busting drug and you can't say that, they need to be able to call somebody. And if the phone doesn't ring because they're on vacation or out of town, who's next? There needs to be a clear list of authority. And because you can plan all you want, but if those plans aren't communicated, they're useless.
Right. Or in a worse scenario, if you've made this plan and since you've last executed your directives, that person has since passed or is not in a capacity to help you,
sure.
Then you need to have a secondary and tertiary plan.
That happens in more than you would think. People make their plans once. It's an emotional difficulty to sit down and plan your own death and think about it, to consider it. At your age, it's not such a big deal, but as people get along in years, they it becomes a real issue. And sitting down, usually with a spouse or with somebody they care about, and start talking about what the end of their life is going to look like, and all these sorts of things, it becomes, it's not something they do lightly, and it's not something that's very comfortable, especially when they're sitting across the desk from somebody who's asking all these kinds of questions. It's really pretty rare you actually have someone who comes in who's prepared on the front end to sit down and talk about these things, and they don't want to go back and do it again in a year or 2 years or three or after a spouse passes away. They just, they don't want to go there. And so getting them to be candid and discuss it with you and trust you and to visit those painful things that they know are coming but nobody wants to really think about, it's difficult. And so, yes, you're right. Planning and updating is all part of the process. It's like any plan. You're always revising it.
When you're going through this planning process, should you also be concerned and thinking about your organ donation wishes one way or the other, and then perhaps religious beliefs as well?
Sure, of course. Of course. You know, in my experience, I've dealt with a number of different types of people, that is, people from different religious and social backgrounds over the years, and it runs a very broad spectrum. I guess probably in the 70s, maybe, don't quote me on this, I'm no expert, but some of the more traditional Christian faiths did not believe in cremation. It was just not something that was part of their religious beliefs. Today, most mainstream religious faiths, I think, say it's okay. I don't know that to be true, but I think that's the case. I haven't had any pushback on it. But some faiths don't allow autopsies, and some faiths don't allow a whole variety of ways of dealing with the deceased. And so those kinds of things are important to put in writing if you have religious preferences about that or moral preferences. You know, there's new techniques. You know, autopsies, if you've ever seen one, are a mess. And people feel, in many instances, many cultures, feel it's a huge desecration. Others say, well, yeah, it's the way it has to be. Texas actually passed a statute a few years ago that makes it possible that for someone to resist an autopsy and if you have religious beliefs against it. And in that point in time, the medical examiner has to come to court and prove there's a real medical need for an autopsy to do this procedure if the family objects. And it's usually in criminal cases, it's where there's a homicide, there's no way out of it. You have to do it. But there are a lot of faiths that and religious backgrounds that view autopsy as desecration. Some don't allow for cremation or embalming, and some require immediate funerals. There's a whole spectrum of religious and social thought. Most of the funeral homes, the funeral providers. Are trained in those things, and it's a sort of strange thing in this world, but it still seems to me that the funeral industry is probably the most unintentionally segregated industry in America. People tend to go to funeral directors who are of similar backgrounds. You know, they're here in Houston, there are certain funeral homes that do Catholics mostly, and there's some that do Jews primarily, and I'm sure there's some that do just about everybody. But it's and people feel more comfortable, I think, with the end of life stuff, dealing with people who are like them. They understand the culture of it better, I guess. But yes, you can plan all that. As a matter of fact, we now in Texas have a separate document where you can appoint an individual to be your agent for the disposition of your remains. And you can list in it exactly what it is that you want done with your remains, including donation of organs and tissue. As people get older, they become less valuable as general organ donors, but there's still things like corneas and skin and a variety of body parts that are useful almost at any age. The there's a children's burns hospital in Houston, in Galveston, and there's always a need for more skin because that seems to be one of the things that is needed all the time when children are burning, because they're constantly replacing it. And often it's only there for a few weeks before they put another layer on. And so if that's within your ability, it's something that you have to say, though. It has to be harvested, too, in a correct way, pretty quickly after death. And so you gotta make it known.
Okay. So moral of that story is, if you want to do good with your body afterwards, you at least need to let people know so it can be captured in the right time frame to still be viable.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Now we can put, you can have general organ donation, I think, on your driver's license, and corneas too, I believe, but that's changed some over the years. But if you really want to be good about planning, you need to think about it like you do everything else. Now, there are a few things besides wills that we now have a bunch of documents that you can execute that you can avoid probate altogether. You can do payable on death accounts so that they stay outside your estate. You can do, you can even convey property now where the conveyance becomes effective on death. Yeah, lots of stuff out there.
All right. Well, we've seen in the last 10 years or so more in the news cycle about physician-assisted suicides.
Yes.
Do you believe that this will become more legalized across the board?
I think so. There seems to be a greater acceptance of it in the public at large. At least that's my perception. Some states in the United States already allow it. I believe Oregon and Washington, maybe some others. The Dutch started that practice many years ago. And my understanding is that it's pretty rare still. Very few people really do it. You can't just have a bad day and go see your doctor and get a lethal pill. You have to be at the end stage of your life, and rather than let the process run through naturally to the end, you can preempt it through this process. And for some people, I suppose that's a valid choice. I mean, anybody who's seeing the ravages of what cancer, end-stage cancer, can do for people, or do to people, you know, stopping that process and the pain and anxiety that it causes sometimes doesn't sound like such a bad idea.
You spoke a little bit earlier about establishing trust as part of the estate planning process. Can you talk with me a little bit about some of the different types of trust that one could set up?
There's all kinds, and they do all kinds of things. We even have dog trust now in Texas, pet trusts. Trusts are a way of separating ownership of property. There's a more technical explanation, but essentially what it does is it lets someone hold legal title to property while for the benefit of someone else. So the car is in the name or the house is in the name of the trustee, but he has to use that property under the terms of the trust instrument for the benefit of the beneficiary. And so you can provide for that in a will. You can provide for it outside of a will. We actually have something in Texas called a Texas Trust Code, which specifies about that. But trusts have always existed for 500 years anyway. And they work pretty well. Only corporations that are licensed as trustees can actually do it, typically banks. There are a couple of private trust companies, and most of the brokerage houses have trust companies, but they have capital requirements and they have to be audited and so on, just like banks do. And trustees are in a position to handle other people's property for long periods of time. There comes a point in time where trusts have to come to an end. And it's a very old rule of law. It's called the law against perpetuities. And it's found in all common law jurisdictions, but the general gist of it is that all trusts have to come to an end during a life or lives in being at the time the trust began, plus a period of 21 years. So if you have in England, some of the British trusts that I've seen will use have a trust existence for at the age of the youngest lineal heir of the Windsor family. So that you'll have people who are, that's the index. So you'll have the newest grandchild of Queen Elizabeth, the great grandchild of Queen Elizabeth, will be the index. And so for that person's life plus a period of 21 years.
So there's a way around that if you start getting creative.
Yeah, but you can't have a trust upon a trust. So it always comes to an end. It's basically about 100 years is about as much as you're going to get. And then the property has to come to an end. A lot of young adults who are writing wills like to do that for their children. And it's because you don't know, in Texas, of course, you reach majority at age 18. And if you think back what you were like at age 18, maybe not the most responsible person. So the idea of having an adult, if you die when your child is 10, and you know when he or she turns 18, there's going to be a fund of money there, either from life insurance or because you've done well in life and you have assets. Would you want that 18-year-old with $500,000? I'm not sure I'd want my 40-year-old with $500,000. But a trust is a way of seeing to it they get the benefit of the money without having control over it. And that, of course, requires that you select people who are of appropriate age and discretion to serve as trustee or use a trust company, a commercial trust company.
Okay. Based on your years of experience, I'm going to ask you for a bit of advice now.
Okay.
So for the planning advice, what would you advise a young family as they're starting this planning process? What should they look for and what steps should they really take?
Well, the first thing I think you should do is decide, if you're a young family, is decide how big your family is going to be. If your family's already reached its likely maximum size, and what ages your children are, and decide what it's going to take in the event you die to see them through to majority, and so they're getting a start in life. What's it going to take for that? Because obviously you won't be here. And of course, there's always the question, if you're a married couple, is your surviving spouse going to remain single? Is there going to be new people in the children's lives? And do you want to keep whatever you're leaving behind separate for the children and not go directly to your spouse? Texas being a community property state, that means your spouse already owns one half of whatever you've got. So all you can dispose of is what you own, which means half. And in the case of, if you take and leave all your community property, you've got a large estate. You leave half of your community property, or leave all of one half of your community property to your children, so that your spouse decides he wants to go marry a girl and go to Vegas, and all the money's gone. Well, you know, you've still got this fund of money. So you leave it in trust for the benefit of your children. Well, that half is theirs. And then you have a trustee who would manage that for their life. A lot of it has to do with your view of what would happen to your family in the event you were to die. You have to know what it is you're starting with. Do you have life insurance that's going to fund some of this? If your life insurance is going to go directly to your surviving spouse, then at the end of the day, you really don't know what's going to happen with it. I'm not suggesting lack of trustworthiness, but people move on and different pressures come to bear. And if all you can do is look at the snapshot of what happens if I die today, what am I going to be doing today? What's going to happen? Likely my spouse is going to move on with their lives. We're 35 years old. What's going to happen? I mean, they're not going to stay single forever and mourn me. So how can I control my little patch? How am I going to control my assets for the benefit of my family, the children I have, and make sure that their futures are secure financially? You can't do much as far as their emotional situation. You can't do much as far as their living circumstances are concerned, because surviving parent, as I said before, will have some control over that in all likelihood. So all you can do is really preserve the assets you've got. And you need to think about that. Those are hard decisions, because most people don't like to think about what if. And of course, as a lawyer, we always plan for the downside. the crazy stuff that nobody, that never really happens but always does. You know, the stuff that you can't imagine. That's what we have to use our fevered brows to come up with. And for most people, things are pretty mundane. People live their lives, live a natural course of life. They don't get hit by meteorites or run over in the street. They live their natural course of life. They die at a suitable age, and you know, they have kids and grandkids and houses and cars and all those sorts of things like everybody else does, probably like your parents or your grandparents or people that you know. But that's not always the case. And planning is about for those things that occur naturally and those things that may be sort of outside the norm. And you have to have enough flexibility to, both in your thinking and in your documentation, to make that work.
Okay. You've talked a couple different times about how things change. So what targeted advice would you give someone after a major life change, like the death of a spouse or a divorce?
Those kinds of major life changes, once you've got your emotional feet under you and you're not making decisions based entirely on emotions, is to begin again. Think about what happens if I die, what happens about all the ramifications and permutations on the known world that you have at that point. I think it's very difficult to, in the case of a death of a spouse, for instance, or a divorce, which can often be like death in many respects, to sit down and make good decisions about what happens if I die, what happens if I get sick, I no longer have a caring spouse who's going to be looking after me if I get terribly ill. How am I going to manage that? How am I going to be able to manage my own affairs? Often people in today's world, particularly young people, in my experience, need two incomes to support the family. I think I'm correct in saying that. If you get a divorce, you have half as much income. So those issues become very, very significant, both in terms of your current cash needs and lifestyle, and how do you plan for the future of your children? Well, you know, to me, life insurance is always, lawyers tend to buy too much life insurance, by the way. I think life insurance is always a useful thing. And it's like everything else, though. It has to be, it's a tool. And it's a tool that you have to use correctly and wisely to provide for those things that, those eventualities that might occur.
Now, suppose someone has made it all the way through towards a bit later stage in their life and they have not executed a will yet or started their process in planning. What advice would you give to them?
Boy, that's tough. Actually, in some ways, it's easier than people on the front end because most of those big life events have already happened. You know, you're now at a stage in your life where you're dealing with I'm retired, or I'm getting close to retirement, and I already know what my whole card is financially. My kids are grown, maybe have grandkids. Are my kids able to support themselves if I were to suddenly die, or my spouse? You start planning on the long, slow slope to the end. And those kinds of issues, again, have to do with first finances, because that's really it. Then you have to deal with medical issues. Medical issues become a bigger issue as you get older, and people age. Particularly as you talked about a few minutes ago, we now live longer. We have lots of life-sustaining stuff. There was a time, not in the very distant past, when there was a big push on for people to buy long-term care insurance, and people were buying it as fast as they could, the pricing model on that by the insurance companies was off. And my understanding is most of the companies have withdrawn from the market. It's hard to buy. And you have to be in very good health to even afford it, to be able to be underwritten for it. So it makes it difficult to buy long-term care insurance. One of the things that's gotten to be in vogue is something called Miller Trusts, which I personally don't care for. I don't know, is that something you'd like me to talk about, Miller Trusts?
Sure.
Miller Trusts are sometimes called Medicaid trusts. Normally, Medicaid does not provide for nursing home care. And so people will now create trust and put all their assets in it, so they essentially become Medicaid eligible. And so long as they can get past a 5-year stretch from the time they create the trust and fund it till the time that they go into Medicaid nursing home, they're okay. There's a 5-year look back period that Medicaid can look to recover those assets. And so people essentially are shifting the burden of nursing home care to the Medicaid system, which was never what Congress intended in the first place, through the use of these Miller trusts. Essentially, keep the assets, you manage them, you're the trustee of your own trust, you manage these assets, or your spouse does for you and you for her, and for this period of 5 years, and then if you can make it that far and you need nursing home care or any other type of assisted living care that Medicaid would pay for, somebody else is footing the bill. Unfortunately, with the absence now really of long-term care and nursing home costs, it's so expensive. Last time I looked, it was, what, $7,000 a month or something like that? Of course, I also saw that the average stay in a nursing home is a year or less. So most people don't make it very long once they get to that stage. But you're still talking about $100,000 a year in costs. Medicare, of course, is something everybody gets at age 65. And Social Security for most people at 66. But those are things that you have to think about. The Miller Trust, the end-of-life expenses, where's the money going to come from? And if I use up all of our money and my spouse is going to live, I mean, women traditionally live longer than men, so what's she going to live on? You know? Those are considerations. There's some elder law lawyers who specialize in doing Medicaid trusts, Miller trusts, and things of that nature. And it's not a practice that I've ever really thought much of, honestly. But I understand the need.
So as we're talking about getting your plan in place, drawing up the will, getting your advanced medical directives in place, how often should someone update these?
Certainly big life changes, big life events, that's a given. I would say within 6 months to a year after a big life event, death of a spouse, that sort of thing. But I would, as you get older, you should plan more frequently because things change more radically. Younger, probably every 5 years, 5 to 10 years maybe in some instances. Realistically, I think you're probably talking as you get towards the end, every 2 or 3 years, should get it out and look at it. I have to tell you, I just recently was able to get a will, an entire estate plan executed for a lady who was dying of cancer. She finally got it signed on Tuesday, and she died that Thursday. So otherwise, she would have died intestate with quite a large estate. People don't like to do it. They don't like to talk about it. They don't like to think about it. They don't like to deal with it. They don't understand it. It's frightening. They feel like the decisions they're making are irrevocable, and they're not. But there's a certain finality to the idea of, I want to be buried in Lot 6, Plot 4 of Garden Oaks Cemetery. That's the period at the end of the sentence. People don't like to think that way. They like to think their lives are expansive. There's always something new going to happen. Life's moving on until it doesn't. So people just don't like to do it. And it costs some money.
Do you have any advice for those adult children who are trying to approach their parents about putting a plan together? And in your experience on the other side of that desk?
That's tough. It can cause a lot of heartache. People, if parents aren't open to the idea, it's really difficult. Usually, I found in my own experience, people come talk to you after someone they know has died. That's when they become more accepted. Someone who's a contemporary dies, and it sort of focuses surviving friends and family on the notion of, my brother just died. Gee whiz, he was younger than I am. I haven't got a will. And then that's the time that they start thinking about it. But adult children talking to their parents is dicey. It involves the entire family relationship and the entire parent-child relationship. It's one thing, some parents, you know, the idea of their kid coming in and saying, hey, Dad, we need to talk about you dying. It doesn't go over very well sometimes. So it has to be, it takes time, it takes thought, it takes respect, and it takes a respectful approach to the problem. And often I think parents might consider it an invasion of the parent-child relationship. You never stop being your parent's child. And, you know, when the kid comes in and says to Dad, who is mature years and lots of experience in life, I want to talk to you, you're getting old. We need to talk about what's going to happen. And it's not easy. But some people are adult about it and say, you know, I'm glad you came in and we talked about it, but not very often in my experience.
So a softer approach for sure.
You bet.
Okay.
You bet. And usually, as I say, you got to think about it. You got to think about how they're taking it on the other side. It's one of those, it's not about the kid who's suggesting it to the parent. It really has to be, you have to view it from the parent's point of view because it's their life. And it's a dicey emotional situation.
Well, thank you for all of your advice today and the insights into how we can better plan and prepare for our futures.
Thank you. It's been fun being here.
Thank you for watching our resources videocast. We would like to thank Alan Laser for sharing his personal experience and wisdom with us about crucial estate planning elements. Make sure to register and reserve your seat now for the first newly enhanced CIC Life and Health Program in Houston, Texas, January 16th through 18th, 2019. For more podcasts, visit our website at scic.com.